If you want to see what the best chance we have to end the war between Russia and Ukraine, it was just on display moments ago, just north of where I am right now, in the Oval Office of the White House. Prime Minister Orban was meeting with President Trump, and they were talking a lot about how the war could end. And one of the reasons why this could give you at least momentarily some of the best hope to end this war is because Viktor Orban is laser focused on the realities on the ground. It's almost like he's watching our show. So he's just one of the other ones that actually does pay attention to reality and then sticks very firmly on that. President Trump, as we all unfortunately know, is influenced by whoever the last person to talk to him was. So right now, that last person was Viktor Orban. And man, does he need to listen to that guy, because if he does, something good could happen. Here is one of the...
We're talking, but we'll report on that later. Meetings with Putin. We were talking about that with Viktor. He understands Putin and knows him very well. And I feel that... I mean, I'm going to let you say what you think, but I think that... Viktor feels we're going to get that war ended in the not too distant future. Viktor, do you want to talk about that?
Well, I'm strongly convinced. So the question is whether we Westerners are unified or not. The problem is that the president has huge peace efforts, which are just splendid and very positive for the European continent and all the peoples of the of Europe. But at the same time, we are not unified because Brussels and the Europeans have a different approach to the war. So the only pro-peace government is the United States government and the small Hungary in Europe anyway. All the other governments prefer to continue the war because many of them think that Ukraine can win on the front line, which is a misunderstanding of the situation.
That's being very diplomatic in Viktor Orban of saying, well, they just don't understand. No, they're just flat dead wrong. Now, we can argue whether the European Union actually thinks, as Orban said there, that the Ukraine side can win. I don't know that that's the truth. I doubt, actually, I'm sure that many people are well aware that it's not, but they're supporting anyway. But he is right that there is no unity among the Europeans. There are a considerable number of them, a majority, that are with the team, so to speak. They're just playing ball with whatever Brussels is saying, with whatever the leadership you're talking about, Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron, Friedrich Merz. I mean, those are kind of the big three ring leaders, and most of the rest of the EU follows in behind that, but not all of them. And Viktor Orban has always been one of the most outspoken. Robert Fico, of course, from Slovakia, but increasingly others as well. There's been issues in Romania. There's been issues in the Czech Republic and some of the other places on some of the other countries are starting to waffle a little bit, but no one's willing to get out of the shadows yet. This is one of those times where if President Trump wanted to, he could finally really emphasize the realities and exert some leadership and just say, you know what, here's where we're going to go. Because one can only imagine, and certainly will hope, that once those cameras leave the room and that working lunch continues on, is that he's going to just tell him, listen, the war can't be won. Whatever you're hearing about these casualty figures, and I'm going to talk on that in a second, but whatever you're hearing, there is no chance for Ukraine to win. There's no chance for Ukraine to avoid loss. It's even worse than that. And whether some Europeans believe it or not, I don't know, but as we saw, and then look on our channel, we just had earlier today an economist that really talked about how, forget about whether there's enough ammunition, weapons, and planes, and tanks, and missiles, and everything else to give to Ukraine from the West. Forget about who's paying it even. That even isn't the main issue. They're not going to have the economic wherewithal to maintain this war of attrition indefinitely. They obviously definitely don't have the industrial capacity, but there are many, many warning signs and alarm bells ringing and lights flashing that their economies are also not going to be able to maintain. And it's going to cause a lot of domestic trouble for each one of them. Even these governments themselves are going to have a hard time remaining in power, which most politicians is priority number one, to keep themselves in a job. So if that pressure holds true, then maybe with enough time and enough influence, they can be invested in the truth, and that they can be convinced to go down a path that actually makes sense for them and recognizes reality. That's what should happen. And if Viktor Orban can really convince Trump and get him to make some decisions and some irrevocable consequences or choices to come after it, then this meeting could be really, really influential. We'll see if that's going to happen. Probably wouldn't be really smart to put a lot of effort on that, because one can only imagine that after this meeting is done, you're going to get the Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron, Volodymyr Zelensky probably will be jumping on the phone lines if they're not already on hold to say, don't listen to him. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Listen to us because we're cool. Who knows what they may say, but that's you can count on that being the case. They will definitely try to undercut whatever Orban is saying. Orban, though, is a very confident, self-assured leader, and he has the facts on his case. So that's kind of the entry level here. Then President Trump was apparently asked, why hasn't this come to an end before? You've been talking about, you know, ending this war since we got since you got into office in January, and it hasn't happened yet. And he offers his reason.
The basic dispute is they just don't want to stop yet. And I think they will. I think it's taken a big toll on Russia, a big toll on both countries, obviously, but it's taken a big toll. They're losing 7,000 soldiers a week. That's a big toll. And up between the two of them, divided, you know, with Russia losing more soldiers, actually. But they're both losing a lot of people. I inherited the war, and I think we're going to get it ended not too distant future.
Okay, that's almost his tagline. He throws away the, but I think we're going to get it done in the not too distant future. That has no relevance to anything, so just kind of ignore that part. But something he said there is something I think that is really, really important to point out here. And one of the things that I'm hoping Viktor Orban can clear him up on, and that is his claim. He says this a lot, has been for months now. There are up to 7,000 soldiers being killed every week in this war. Most of them Russians, he said. They had these huge casualties. Many of the estimates in the West put it at over 1 million killed in action, or a combination of killed and wounded. 1.3 million, I've heard that number tossed around. Lots of Russian casualties, and they just can't keep going on this way. So that is almost certainly untrue. And I have heard from, ironically, from two very separate and very well-connected sources just this week that says that there is some real problems within the U.S. intel community. And these folks are telling the senior leaders of our country across the board, and definitely including both the president and the vice president, all these casualty figures. They're saying the Russians are suffering this huge amount, that their economy is wobbling, it's about to collapse, et cetera. Because from what I'm told, and all I have is these two persons, but these two individuals are completely disconnected. They have no relation to each other whatsoever, and yet they told me virtually the identical story, and that is that the intel community exaggerates or makes up from whole cloth a lot of the problems and the claims of issues with the Russian side to make it look like you just got to stick a little further. You just got to keep going a little bit more. Yeah, there you go. 1.1 million since the invasion, says Britain. That's a connection as well. The idea is that look at all these losses they've had. They can't sustain this much longer. Their economy won't be able to do it. We've got 19 rounds of sanctions plus what Trump just put on there. We just need a little bit more and more time. We got a 20th package working right now. That's what we need to work on. So don't get weak-kneed. Don't, you know, go wobbly on us. We just got to keep the pressure on. See, I think some people, and certainly it's not just the U.S. You can definitely see Britain. They're the other leader, maybe even the co-leaders in this wanting this war to continue on, many in Britain, is that they like, no, I believe it. I bet with enough pressure and time, we just have to be consistent. So they're not looking at what we're looking at, and they're not seeing that the Ukraine side and the Ukraine casualties, which probably are close to that amount, and it's rational and logical that they would be for very practical reasons. These kind of folks seem to be myopically focused on what they perceive is the casualty count and the difficulty and what the Russians could face going forward, oblivious to the collapsing fabric of the army on the Ukraine side and the fact that they're running out of people and that the entire West writ large doesn't have an industrial base that could be able to maintain a war of attrition that you can just look and see that the Russians do. So there is a real problem with this. But just imagine if you're President Trump and you're hearing from your highest ranking intelligence officials that, yes, the Russians are suffering. You just have to keep going. And all this big stuff, that's why he understands that there is. He keeps repeating this over and over. I've said many times, you know, they can't really believe this stuff. They must just be saying it for public consumption. But as I'm told by some people who have direct knowledge, and I mean direct knowledge, they're saying that no. They say that because they believe it because they're being told that. And even what I have said to these two separate sources and have said to you guys many times when we're talking is that, look, you can hear that stuff and you can hear these reports or read them or whatever, but when you look at the ground, it's self-evident that that's not true. It can't be true. It's logically inconsequential. It's logically irrelevant. It can't be true. If one side has 3 to 5 to, in some locations, 10 to 1 manpower exaggeration advantages, and the same in the air power and the firepower across the board, complete mastery in the glide bombs, it's not even a 10 to 1. They don't have that category on the Ukraine side, so it's all for against none. And now that they're increasing both the lethality and the range of these things, making it even more difficult to knock down at all, making them hit more and more effectively. And then, of course, the Russians have an advantage of the drones. Anything you want to look at, all the categories that matter, the Russians have them. So if you're being told this, at some point you got to go, hang on, because I've been hearing this for better part of 10 months now, and it ain't been true so far, because it's not. So the hope is that maybe Viktor Orban can kind of step in there and say, Mr. President, you're being told the wrong stuff, because he's got his own intelligence community, folks. And the reason why he's so confident in what he's saying right there and has said nearly all the way through is because probably he's been given accurate information by his intelligence services, and he looks at the ground. He can just see and he can count and he can observe all the things that we've seen and many more things that we could talk about here. But then they shifted over to Viktor Orban and they asked him, what do you think about this and where do you see it going?
No question that if that time the name of the United States president would have been Donald Trump, there would be no war between Ukraine and Russia. That's clear. But what we are speaking about here is more than that, because without the pressure coming from the United States government, I'm speaking 2022, the Europeans would not take that hard line what they have today on the war. Because that was an enormous mistake, what we have done, I mean, the Western world several years ago, and we have to stop it, and it's common responsibility.
So he says, as a lead into what we have to do right now, he goes back to really before the war and says that the West, and he definitely has to include the previous administration, because, you know, I think what he was directly addressing there was Trump's comment that I believe he even said in one of those previous sound bites I had, says all the time, though, that, you know, this wasn't my war. If I'd have been in power at the time, there wouldn't have been a war, et cetera. Viktor Orban is agreeing with that. He says, yeah, I think that is the case. And he very graphic. And I agree with that, too. I do. I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think that Trump wouldn't have, because he didn't want wars. And he certainly didn't want a war with Russia. There was many practical reasons why he wouldn't. And so there was so many off-ramps and abilities. But the Biden administration wasn't interested in off-ramps, and definitely the UK government was not interested in off-ramps either. And once you got UK and US together, it doesn't matter what anybody else says. They're going to fall in line, and there doesn't appear that there was much pushback from anywhere. You know, we've had showed Jens Stoltenberg was just as much. I mean, he was enthusiastic. He was probably thrilled at what London and Washington were saying at the time, and Orban was not. And his view was the minority view, a significant minority view, and it didn't hold any sway. And obviously they went forward with it, and, you know, we have what we have. So now then the question is, what are we going to have next? Because you still have the UK, France, and Germany, and some other European states, and definitely Brussels and NATO still are pushing to this day. Mark Rutte just yesterday in Romania, just continues to just harp on the case over and over. My God, we have to arm up now. We have to continue to increase our defense spending because even after this war is over, Russia's coming after us and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So they're like already looking beyond the war and saying, well, we got to keep this gravy train rolling. And so the gravy train won't keep rolling unless you build up this fear that there is this big monster that's going to come get you if you don't arm up there. And so they're still pushing that direction. Viktor Orban, on the other hand, is a big time opponent of it because he sees it's a losing proposition that will not help his country, will not help Europe, will not help stability and prosperity and peace for the entire continent. So he has been relentless in pushing for diplomatic into this. And that's why I say, at least I have a shred of hope that maybe he can convince Trump that some of these claims that he's been getting from apparently our own intelligence community are not accurate. And what he's telling him is, which is the same thing here. President Trump could watch our show. We'd be happy to give him a private briefing should he ask for that. And that we would support this view that apparently Viktor Orban has. And then we could get to a negotiated settlement pretty quick. As it turns out, the Russian sides also agree with some of these comments. Now, let me just comment here. Because anytime anybody ever mentions anything about the Russian side of the Russian viewpoint, the pretty much reflexive reaction is you're a Putin talking point, whatever. As though you can't even mention what the other side in a war wants or what they're saying without being an apologist. And that is asinine. It is absurd. It is self-defeating. And gone far enough, it will be self-destructive. And I reject it wholeheartedly and full cloth. Because if you don't know what the other side says, if you don't know what they want, and if you're not willing to talk to them to try to find out, is there common ground anywhere? Can we find some common ground that we can agree with and then work on the areas where they're not? If you don't even talk to them, there is this much chance that you're going to get anything done. And then you guarantee that the only path you leave for your opposition is war and more war. And ultimately, because of the balance of power that exists between the two sides, you condemn Ukraine to death. That's where we are. So we're not going to follow that path. Viktor Orban doesn't. President Trump doesn't. I'm a critic of President Trump in many areas, but when he's right, I'm going to congratulate him and enthusiastically support it. This is one of those times. I have said from the beginning that at least, unlike his predecessor, he is willing to talk and engage with the Russians. Now, I wish he would do a little bit more on the decisive action stuff because there could have been some off-ramps he could have taken, but he was listening to other people. We'll talk about that another day. But right now, that's still the possibility. But we are going to listen to what the Russian says because it shows that Orban is also listening and has a rational, logical path to get this war over with without the complete and total destruction of hundreds of thousands of more Ukrainians, the destruction of more cities at all. Here is, in fact, earlier today, maybe it was yesterday, Dmitry Peskov is saying something very similar. Before this meeting had even taken place, here's how he saw it.
Но главное, что сейчас тормозит процесс урегулирования, это та пауза, которая возникла из-за нежелания украинской стороны идти по пути политики дипломатического урегулирования и из-за провоцирования, собственно, киевского режима со стороны европейцев на продолжение дальнейших боевых действий. Безусловно, говорить сейчас о каком-то взаимном доверии не приходится.
Yeah, so he was asked, you know, is there any mutual trust between these two sides? It's ridiculous to even talk about it because right now we aren't even talking. So you've got NATO and you've got, of course, all the leading European countries continuing to only talk about war. Keir Starmer relentlessly talks about supporting Ukraine, giving them the Storm Shadow missiles. That's even in this past week. There's been reports that there's been more Storm Shadow missiles given, helping Ukraine fire deeper into Russia. Something, I don't know if it was Storm Shadow or even something domestically produced by Ukraine, had a major strike on a Russian oil facility, another one in the southern part of their country. That certainly is going to be felt. It's certainly going to be a pain point. But unfortunately, as I keep telling people over and over, it's just a small number. And whatever these pain points are, they're pinpricks. And they can annoy Russia, but they're not going to stop them. Because you don't have to figure this out. Look at that. The number of missiles fired by Russia in just this month dwarfs by a substantial margin anything that the West is going to do. And when you add in all the glide bombs, the multiple launch rocket or multiple launch rockets, and the drones, especially the Garand drones, both the twos and the threes, hundreds of them, actually into the thousands when you're talking about the month. I think there was 40,000 so far this year have been launched by the Russian side. The month of October was the biggest one yet. They keep growing. They keep getting bigger. And that doesn't even count the somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 drones in the tactical level per day, per day. That's what's happening on the front line there. So it's absurd to say we're just not going to talk and we're just going to keep fighting and we're going to keep giving these pinprick capabilities to the Ukraine side. It briefs well and it works well in the Western media, and it sounds good to somebody who doesn't understand the scale and the off the charts imbalance between what the two sides are doing. And the fact that even with Russia, with all of this stuff and a paucity of air defense capacity, still can't knock Ukraine out of the war at the strategic level, then it's beyond absurd to suggest that a handful is going to have anything, any negative effect, measurable effect on the Russian side. And it hasn't. All the stuff that we've done for now nearly 4 years, it hasn't worked. Whether you've had Hodges constantly, we need more long-range weapons. Remember, 2000, at the end of 2022, at the beginning of 2023, he audaciously said that Ukraine would be in Crimea by the August of 2023. That's what he said before the offensive, even after it obviously failed. He still stayed with that. We just need to give them the long-range missiles. Well, they got long-range missiles, and it didn't make any difference. They got the F-16s, and it didn't make any difference. They have all these, the Storm Shadow missiles, the ATACMs, all this stuff, and it never mattered. And instead of acknowledging reality like Viktor Orban is doing, like he's trying to get President Trump to do, they just stay oblivious to this and continue going forward. Now, Maria Zakharova, she doesn't just blame Ukraine, Europeans altogether. She pinpoints in on the UK.
Times change, but the malicious goals of the Russophobes in Britain toward our country and the inhumane methods of achieving them remain the same. Supplying explosives and weapons, sponsoring murders and terrorist acts, intimidating the civilian population. The same arsenal of influence measures is traditionally kept ready in London for anyone who disagrees with its neo-colonial mindset and practices. It seems that this disease of the British political class is incurable and only produces increasingly terrible ulcers throughout the entire British community.
So I'm not sure how far that last part's going to go about, causing ulcers in the British community. I doubt that they're needing any help from Maria Zakharova to let them feel any of their pain. They're probably doing that on their own. But some of her points are valid. It's the only thing the UK cares about is more weapons. And then you have how all of this impacts on Volodymyr Zelensky, because it was mentioned there about, I think Peskov said the same thing in his comments, that all of the Europeans, they keep encouraging the Ukraine side to reject any offer for peace and move forward. Now, let's bear in mind that there has been, I may be getting the numbers wrong, somewhere between 5 and maybe even 7 phone calls between Trump and Putin since he was inaugurated in January. There's been numerous visits from Witkoff, who has gone and talked sometimes many, many hours long conversations with Putin. Putin and Trump met in Alaska. Of course, they just had another 2.5 hour phone call the other day. The Russians continue to say, we're willing to have conversations. We're willing to have discussions. They had some direct bilateral meetings in Istanbul, 2 levels of it directly with the Ukraine, all that this year. Okay. Bear in mind, I'm saying all this for a reason. That's a lot of diplomatic activity that's gone on, that the Russians continue to show that they're willing to have a diplomatic settlement on their terms. And those terms are ugly, but they are at the table and they're willing to talk. However, when you listen to the president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, you might come up with a different idea.
Regarding your point about Russia being at the negotiating table, frankly, I'm surprised, because so far, no one has been able to bring the Russians to the table, neither the US president nor any European leader. So I'm just surprised even by this signal regarding. This is exactly what everyone wants, to make Russians start talking.
I mean, what do you do with that, right? If I really wish I could show that soundbite to President Trump right now with Viktor Orban sitting at that table and say, this is the guy you're working with here. All those things I just mentioned, your phone calls, these people that have your adversary or emissaries that you've sent off, the conversations that have happened, the direct conversations between Russia and Ukraine, all of these talks, all of these claims of the Russians, to include today from Dmitry Peskov, they're still willing to talk, but the clock is running down on that. And yet, here's this guy. He actually sits there and says to the cameras, he was asked specifically one of the reporters, and he mocked the reporter. I can't believe you're even asking that question. Everybody's trying to get Russia to the table, but they won't come. That's why we need all these sanctions. We've got to force them to come to the table, and they won't do it. So I can't believe you asked a question. One may reasonably ask, are you intellectually capable of engaging with America, with Donald Trump? If your understanding of reality is so disjointed and so disconnected completely from objective reality. See, if he says, well, we've been talking to them all year and we've had these conversations, some private, some public, but we're just, we can't narrow the gap. That would be one thing. That would still be a problem, but at least it's a matter of interpretations. But instead, he's just saying, we got to get them to the table. They're not even at the table. And he's been saying that a lot. I just grabbed this one because it was so recent. That was just a few days ago. But he's sitting there saying, we're just trying to get them to the table so that we can start the negotiations. Now, almost certainly what he really means is we want to get them to the table on our terms. And so these things that we know they've had, that they've communicated to us, these 12-point plans and all this kind of stuff, we don't like any of it. And so we gave them our own 12-point plan, which, is, of course, is detached from reality because the side that has the power is certainly not going to submit and give in to the side that's on the lower side of the balance of power. But he wants them to say, no, we want to change it and flip it so that we won't talk to them until they come begging us for a deal. And here's the perverse part that's also true. And man, don't miss this, folks. Don't miss this. In the event that conditions on the battlefield were to change to the point that Russia would say, all right, you know what? The pain is getting a lot higher here. We've been hitting these oil infrastructures. I tell you what, we're going to go ahead and we'll go ahead and talk now. This issue where you just want to freeze the line of contact and have negotiations there. Sure, we'll do it. The minute that the Ukraine side and the European side thinks that, whoa, Russia is now going weak kneed. Now that they're willing to talk here, the last thing they're going to do is have a negotiation. They're not going to talk anything. They're going to go, man, we need more pressure. We need to push even harder, and then we'll get them back. Do you understand what I'm saying? The mentality here is that the second that they perceive an advantage, they aren't going to give in on anything. So there's no truth to it. They are not saying we want Russia to come back so that we can have a negotiated settlement here. I don't even think that they thought this through in their own minds here, because there's just no way they're going to accept that. If they would accept it, we would have already seen it, because this is not theoretical. We've already had this in November of 2022. So after Ukraine had what's almost certainly going to be their two battlefield victories in the entire war, which is when they forced Russia to abandon Kherson City and a large swath of the southern part of their holdings, and when they drove them out of large sections of the Kharkiv region in the north, the U.S. The Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, went public, and this is even during the Biden administration, and says, I'm just talking out loud here. I'm paraphrasing, of course. I'm just talking out loud here, but it would be a really good idea if, I don't know, somebody said, hey, how about we have a negotiated settlement now? Because the Russians are hurting. They're hurting real bad, he said. And this is the best time to have a negotiated settlement. When they're on their back foot, they had just announced a mobilization of 300,000, and they were having a whale of a difficult time matriculating them in because they didn't have uniforms, belts, buckles, bullets, guns. I mean, they didn't have anything that people needed. They were literally just throwing whatever they could on these guys and throwing them up to the front to stem the tide there, and it took them a long time to get that under order. So they were definitely on the back foot. They had not yet even started the large-scale recruitment drive that would later be very successful. Meanwhile, the Ukraine side had all of its success. So you had an American general who said, this is your time. You can get a pretty good deal right now. And they could have. They could have gotten a good deal. But instead, the minute Zelensky saw those two battlefield successes, his eyes got this big and he just couldn't see anything else. And he couldn't look at the fact that, okay, the potential, the industrial capacity, the personnel capacity, and the potential that each side had was still way off the charts. You never had a chance to, those didn't change. Whatever happened on the tactical and even operational battlefields didn't change the strategic calculation at all. It didn't change the life and death issue, the existential threat that the Russians viewed. That didn't change at all. The only thing it changed was a temporary momentum on the battlefield, which could have been predictable. But when you had a chance to do what's rational and saying, this is the best we're going to get, we can probably get a negotiated settlement that will not be the terrible deal that they have now. They didn't take it. And obviously, they didn't take the one in April 2022 in Istanbul either. But they rejected the last chance because it looked like they were on the top. So now then, if ever anything happened in the future, they would do the same thing again. It's the same people. Why would they be different going in forward? They're not going to. But this time, they're not going to get that chance. So where we are right now, let's just be frank and let's just call this out right now. So right now, as we're speaking, Donald Trump, Viktor Orban are somewhere in the White House having these conversations. If Trump was smart, and I would wager a lot of money that Orban is giving him a plan somewhat like this, let's end the war now. Let's say we're going to stop our support for Ukraine, and we're going to stop giving this open-ended military equipment, and we're going to insist that Europe and Ukraine come up with the best deal that they can. And we'll push as hard as we can and not just hand over to Russia whatever, a blank piece of paper, whatever they're asking for, but we'll still push you. And there is some leverage. They do have some things that they could, even through offer to remove sanctions, to cause other pressure some other places, to drag some things out. There are some, not a lot, but there's a little bit of leverage. But they could play that because Russia has an incentive and a motivation to get the war over. They also want the war over. They, despite this absurd comic view of what the Russians want is rebuild the USSR, there's no evidence of that. But there is lots of evidence that they want the war over through negotiations. If nothing else, put them to the test. But you could do that right now. And if Trump is firm and staunch, says, hey, we'll help Ukraine with, instead of throwing all these billions of dollars that the Europeans are doing into just an empty hole of more bullets and bombs that can't change the outcome, we'll put some money into helping rebuild. We'll get the best deal for them we can, et cetera. Something that actually has a positive outcome, something that helps build economic activity, that helps all kinds of people. Lots of things that you could do there. That's one option. And I bet Viktor Orban is pushing toward that. And if Trump were to just tighten his belt up and just say, all right, I'm just going to go all in on this, something that actually is logical and rational, this is where we're going to go, this would be a lot less bad than it's going to be. I notice I didn't say that'd be a good outcome, because there is no good outcome available. It's way too late for that. But there is an acceptable outcome that can end the damage and start slowly the process of rebuilding and recovery and all kinds of things that would portend ability to have a peaceful and prosperous future for all of Europe, for Russia, for Ukraine, and the United States, that would take to way low levels any risk of nuclear escalation or any other kind of conflict. That is 100%, without a question, the area and the way we should go. If we don't, if that's not what happens, or if after Orban leaves and somebody gets in line next and Keir Starmer gets on the phone, Emmanuel Macron gets on the phone, and they walk Trump back to where he was before, then almost certainly the outcome is going to be the destruction of Ukraine. The destruction of the Ukrainian government under Zelensky, given enough time and the resources that already exist, Russia will end up going for it. You saw Larry Johnson earlier this week that he said, in his view, this means probably going all the way and taking Odessa in the south, cutting off completely the access to all the ports in both the Azov and the Black Seas, going up to probably Kharkiv City in the north, possibly even up to the Kiev, if it went that far, all the way through the Dnieper River and all areas even close to that, all the way up to the northern part. I mean, they could literally lose everything. And that, if you don't reach the goal, the diplomatic goal I laid out there, understand this, folks. The only thing you're leaving Russia is what I just described there. There's no other option. They don't have the ability to just say, all right, you know what? I'm tired of this war. Let's just stop here and we'll just call it a day and keep what we have, because now all of the conditions that led to the war are still fully engaged, and all of the pipelines from NATO and all these things that the Europeans have been doing since this war started are all fully engaged and will only ramp up over time. And so Russia would logically say that will only mean that they're going to build back up until there's another war, except they'll be a lot stronger whenever they choose to do it later. It would be insane for Russia to do that. So the only logical thing you are giving to the Russian side is to say you must conquer everything. That is, listen to me carefully, folks, here in November, the 2025, that's where we are. That's where this inflection point, that's why this meeting is potentially so important, because you're at an inflection point. You can go this way, do something that makes sense and could change the course of history for all of Europe. Or you cannot take that path and just let the status quo go and just keep on listening to all these guys in Europe. And you were virtually writing the death sentence and the death certificate for Ukraine and keeping alive and keeping higher the risk of conflict between the West and the East, and keeping alive the possibility of nuclear conflict later on, or direct clash between NATO and Russia, and in which everybody loses. Russia won't win in that case. We won't win in that case. We'll lose a lot worse. The way I just lay it out here is a success. I don't think I would go so far as to call it a win because of the disaster and the wreckage that's already existed for the last nearly 4 years, but it could be a success. It could be a medium and long-term success. And I pray to God that we get that done. We'll wait and see. We'll stay on top of it like we always do, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to give you the truth, no matter what it is, no matter what anybody thinks about it. The truth is the truth. And that's what we lay it out there. As a reminder, we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. A lot of your friends, I think, actually like to get your information via podcast, and they'll listen to that more than they'll watch a video. Don't let them miss out on this stuff too. Send that information to them. Same thing on the written format. Others like to get their information being read. And so we are on Substack at DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. So however you want to get your information, we've got it there available for you. So be sure and pass that on to your friends, and we will look forward to seeing you tomorrow morning on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.